court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia. Two Dudes Perspective on Legal Frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude. Well, Michael, at our house, we've been burning the candle on both ends this week.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. By the time that this is released, we will have just completed our first weekend of production. But right now, we're 2 days from opening, and it's all hands on deck.
Yeah?
Something to fix all the time.
I get to come to the advanced performance on Thursday night. That's the dress rehearsal.
Yeah, the final dress rehearsal. We have close friends and families to come so that we have a little bit of an audience to work in front of.
Yeah.
Get some feedback on so we can correct anything that we think needs correcting, last minute tweaks.
Well, I'm sure it's going to be awesome. You all always do an awesome job of putting on those plays. I always enjoy them a lot.
Well, good. We feel like we have the best set this year that we have ever had. It is second to none. And the performances are just unbelievable. The orchestra sounds great. It is really going to be a good show.
Well, I know the set looks amazing because I came by last week, I think, to drop something off to you during practice, and it was markedly different. I mean, it was massive.
It's beyond what people would expect from community theater.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. And it seemed like the ones in the past were just smaller scale and kind of movable. This just looks like it looks like a castle. I mean, it really does.
It does.
It looks like a ride at Disney.
Yeah. We were lucky. We have a couple that's a retired couple that moved here to be near their grandchildren, and he was in construction and she's an artist, and they kind of made this their passion project.
Now, what character does Riley play?
She is Babette, and the French feather duster.
Oh, she's a feather duster.
Yes.
Okay. When you said burning the candle at both ends, I was afraid she was a candle.
No. That's Lumiere.
Lumiere? Okay.
Or Lumiere. That's another one of those pronunciation things. I don't know. I guess they're French. Lumiere. I think that's how you say it.
Lumiere?
Yeah. L-U-M-I-E-R. So here in West Virginia, we'd probably say that. Lumiere.
Hey, Lumiere, get over here.
Yeah. Lumiere. Something like that. I'm not sure.
Well, today's episode, and I was trying to think of a segue to tie in with Beauty and the Beast about what we're talking about today, but I'm drawing a blank here.
Well, it's hard to mix cell phones and classic theater.
Well, you know,
don't turn them on. We tell everybody, turn them off at the start of the show. We tried it. That's evolved.
Yeah.
We used to say turn off all pagers and all that. We don't tell them turn off their pagers. Tell them turn off their cell phones now.
Well, this episode is going to be on the Fourth Amendment and cell phone usage, because there's some interesting changes that are coming about in the law. And the government getting your cell phone data is both a beauty and a beast,
there you
depending
go.
On who, what side of the case you're on.
There's your segue, huh?
Just in the nick of time.
So, I can tell you, as somebody that, you know, cell phones is something that developed throughout my life, where, you know, I've spent more of my life without cell phones around than I have with cell phones. Whereas younger people, they don't really think about cell phones because they're just a part of their life all the time.
Right.
But for me, I know when it first came out, because, you know, when you had your landline, you had wires connected to your house, and you had your picture in your mind of the switchboard operator, like Lily Tomlin on the old Laugh-In,
yeah.
Ronan Martin's Laugh-In, and you had that picture in your mind, and that was how your calls got to you. It's beyond me how a cell phone call gets to you. You're out driving around somewhere. How do they find you? You know, how does that work? I don't even understand any of that. To me, cell phones are magic. They're just, even leave out the smartphone stuff, the Googling and texting and all the other stuff. Cell phones are just magic, how you ever get a call or get one out. I don't know.
It's not even getting a Clash Royale, the little game.
Yeah. I don't even understand all those things.
Technology has definitely come a long way. I remember when I first had my first cell phone, I was actually kind of late getting one. I didn't get one until I was in law school. But I had some friends that had one that was when they were college, which was great because I'd always be like, hey, Ed, can I borrow your cell phone?
Yeah.
So I had a couple of friends that actually worked at the cell phone store. So they always had cell phones as well. And they had some sort of secret access code where they could access the tower without being charged minutes. It was some sort of thing they did where they tested phones. So they could talk on their phone nonstop and not have to worry about going over their minutes.
Not have to be nights and weekends?
No, not nights and friends and family weekends.
Remember when that was a thing?
Yeah.
You could talk nights and weekends and not count against your minutes?
Well, basically cell phones, I mean, they're not magic. They have towers and they're basically everywhere you go.
Are they magical towers?
They can be. They're magical if you're the landowner because the cell phone company pays you a hefty ransom to have it on your property.
Unlike billboard companies.
Yeah, exactly.
They don't pay you anything. They just commandeer you.
I looked at
I still got a bone to pick on that.
Well, we'll see about picking that bone. I looked at a contract for one of those cell phone towers that was on somebody's property. They definitely paid them some money to put that cell phone tower there. What's really funny is I know exactly where it is. And for whatever reason, my service always drops as I come around that corner. And I know there's a cell phone tower there. I know for a fact there is. I just don't understand why my cell phone covers.
There's something between you and that cell tower that you don't see something.
It might be all those leaves on the trees now. I don't know.
There's a lot of spots around West Virginia that don't get reception that other places take for granted because of the hills and everything.
Oh, no doubt. Yeah, you go out in the country, or especially if you're out when I was camping.
More in the country. Most of West Virginia is the country, but there's some that's even countrier than this country.
That's true. Well, I was at Watoga State Park, and I was camping there, and there was no cell phone coverage there. But they're actually, the campsite did have Wi-Fi, believe it or not.
Well, you hit Route 10 to go down to Logan, and you're in the dark the whole way there. You can't get cell reception except very, very intermittently, you know, just very few select spots.
That's right. You got to download your podcast ahead of time.
That's right.
Well, the interesting thing about these cell phone towers and your cell phones is that basically your phone pings these towers. The cell phone companies are able to ascertain the position or location of your mobile phone, whether you're stationary or moving, by looking at the data from these towers. The way this localization occurs, they can either do it through, I guess, some sort of triangularization between multiple cell phone towers to kind of figure out where you are, or, I mean, I think that was more towards like radio frequencies, how they used to triangulate people's positions from radio frequencies. Or alternatively, they can use the GPS now, because most phones have GPS on them. That's part of the global system for mobile communications, GSM. And basically, that can give pretty much a pinpoint accuracy where your cell phone is. And if you're the owner of that cell phone, then basically it follows that they know exactly where you are, because you always have it with you.
That's tracking you as you're moving and using it, though, right?
Yes, but it also sends intermittent signals when you're not even using it.
Right, but what I'm saying is there's two different things. They can track you, actively track you by your phone, but then there's also historical data.
Oh, yeah, they can go backwards. I mean, they could do it real time and follow you, or they can go back and check records and things like that as well.
So if they were surveilling you, they would be using those methods as far as, you know, triangulating and all that to see where you're at. If you're trying to solve a crime, maybe, then you go back and look at historical data that's stored in cell towers.
Right. But I think they can access the cell tower stuff pretty much contemporaneously, too, I believe. I don't know.
Okay. I don't know either. I've just always heard them talk about the pings on cell towers.
Yeah. So this actually, the first time I think I heard about this, like in the mainstream media, was during the big podcast. It was called Serial. And Audio Boom actually had a podcast that followed up on that. It was really successful. It's called Undisclosed. So we'll give a shout out to our fellow Audio Boom podcast, Undisclosed.
Audio Boom, Undisclosed. That was a shout out.
That was a shout out. Undisclosed basically featured two different lawyers they investigated, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller. And Simpson basically saw a couple sentences from a fax cover sheet sent by AT&T along with the accused subpoenaed subscriber activity report, which showed the different cell phone towers. And basically on those instructions, it said that incoming calls are not reliable for determining location. And this was an older case. I think technology's come a little along the ways, but so what she basically found was that the incoming calls couldn't really determine location exactly. So that was the big deal in that case. And that guy actually got a new trial.
Yeah. They were saying outgoing calls applied, but incoming calls didn't, and they didn't exactly secure that. I mean, they didn't go over that information properly when presenting it.
Yeah. Did you listen to that podcast?
No.
Either of those?
No, I haven't. I heard about it.
Yeah. Did you read about it?
And somebody kind of briefed me about what it was about.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it, like the Making a Murderer thing, you sure get the impression that there was a lot of stuff working against this guy.
Yeah.
So I don't know. But, I came across that, too, when I was looking at it. And about the judge in Maryland that was granted a new trial for the guy after that serial podcast.
Yeah.
And they said it's because his own attorney failed to cross-examine an expert witness about cell tower data linking the accused guy to the murder.
Yeah.
And there were several more. There were several more that I read. And it was basically saying that the prosecution knew how to use this data. And they would use it, like maybe they didn't present all of it. They presented the parts that made their case look good. And the defending attorneys didn't really know as much about it and didn't know what questions to ask and some things like that.
Yeah.
So they're going back now and giving these people new trials because they're saying basically they weren't properly defended in the case. If this is the crux of your case, putting somebody right at the location.
Well, now the prosecutor does have a duty to give you any exculpatory evidence that might be in the case.
Yeah.
So,
but if he hands you these list of calls or pings or whatever it is, you got to have some kind of knowledge of how these things work to know where to go with it.
Yeah.
So he could say, yeah, I gave him all the evidence just because he didn't know how to read the report. It's not my fault.
Yeah. If you go on Reddit, they have a page or Reddit or subreddit that's dedicated to this serial podcast. And basically it has some really detailed maps of the different cell phone towers and where the people were at certain times, things like that. Like they really present it graphically on there. It's pretty interesting. So, but now this case we're talking about that's coming to the Supreme Court is U.S. v. Carpenter. That case is not necessarily about the accuracy and, I guess, the duty to present it in court. Really, what this turns on is about whether or not the government needs a warrant to access this data from the cell phone tower. And this kind of circles back to our whole Fourth Amendment discussion we had a couple weeks ago. And that's why we thought this would be a good kind of follow-up episode to touch on, because this is something that's kind of in the news, too.
And we also mentioned that these laws are constantly being challenged and updated due to technology constantly changing and updating. So they constantly are being reinterpreted all over again. How about reinterpreted?
Is that better? That sounds good.
Okay. That sounds real good.
Sounds real good, Clark.
Get yourself something extra nice.
So basically, the government has been accessing the cell phone tower information without search warrants, and the ACLU believes this to be an illegal search and seizure, but the government does not. And that's basically they're agreeing to disagree on this right now. The government is essentially relying on an older case, and this is the Smith v. Maryland case, and this is from 1979. And this was a case in which the U.S. Supreme Court held that the installation and use of a PIN register was not a search within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment, and no warrant was required. Now, a PIN register was basically something that was installed at the phone company and basically kept a log of what numbers a phone called. And they stated there was no expectation of privacy for this information. So that was kind of similar to what you're talking about, the old switchboard operator. You know, I guess if maybe the switchboard operator wrote down
every number
they did and what they did, that would be kind of the same thing. But a PIN register just basically did that automatically.
So you could show who called who and what time.
Yeah. Now you couldn't get the.
It didn't keep the transcripts of the conversations. It was just strictly a number to number and probably the length of the call or something like that.
Exactly. Now this Smith v. Maryland case was based on a case we talked about during that Fourth Amendment podcast, the Katz v. U.S., which was a 1967 case.
Right.
And that's where
that was the one with the phone booth and the listening device, right? Yeah,
exactly. The one we talked about before. That was the U.S. Supreme Court case that established the whole reasonable expectation of privacy test, wherein they held basically you needed a warrant to bug a phone, or you need a warrant if there's a reasonable expectation of privacy. That was where that was the genesis of that whole kind of test or that whole theory. In the Smith case, the Smith v. Maryland case about the PIN registers, they felt that Smith was different from the Katz case because basically the defendant would have to disclose the numbers to the telephone company before the call could be connected. So the court held that, first, we doubt that people in general entertain any actual expectation of privacy in the numbers they dial. all telephone users realize that they must convey phone numbers to the telephone company, since it is through a telephone company switching equipment that their calls are completed. All subscribers realize, moreover, that the phone company has facilities for making permanent records of the numbers they dial, for they see a list of their long-distance toll calls on their monthly bills. In fact, PIN registers and similar devices are routinely used by telephone companies for the purposes of checking billing operations, detecting fraud, and preventing violations of law. And that was from the from that case. So
that's not just talking about cell phones. That's talking about phones in general, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So but that's kind of the basis for that whole...
But they're tying that into cell phone usage.
Exactly. So if you see where they're coming from, I mean, if you think about a PIN register, does it have a reasonable expectation of privacy? I don't think so. I mean, I think they're probably kind of right about that.
Well, one of the other things that I've heard along those same lines in defense of it is that you're not the, what was it, San Bernardino, where they went to all the time and money to try to get the phone unlocked because mm-hmm. they wanted to see what he had done on his phone, who he had talked to and all that kind of stuff. And,
yeah.
And Apple wouldn't cooperate and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Unlike the phone itself, which is the possession of somebody. So now you're asking to look into their possession. You know, you'd need a search warrant for that. But the cell phone tower is actually owned by a carrier or a third party. And so your data is going through this third party. It's not really yours. It's going through this third party or the carrier. So, you know, it's kind of out in the public. So that would take away from your expectation of privacy too. That's not your stuff. It's somebody else's.
That is true. But, you know, there's some different arguments to be made for whether or not the cell tower is, you know, since it gives away your location, if you have an expectation of privacy for that. So that's kind of the difference, I think.
But as far as if you're looking at search warrant or not, is that your personal property they're searching?
Well, I think the other question is under the Fourth Amendment, do you have a reasonable expectation of privacy? And that's really what it turns on.
Right.
And I think your location... you probably do have a reasonable expectation of privacy, I think. And if you do, then they're required to get a search warrant for that. And I mean, they're not saying they can't have the information. They're basically just saying that you need to go through a judge and have a judge sign off on it before you can get that information.
Here's the one question I have. I mean, maybe a search warrant is a lot harder to get than what I have in my mind of what it is, because, you know, on TV shows or movies or whatever, it's like, yeah, we've got him now. Get a search warrant for it. You know, the next scene, they're breaking in the doors with their search warrant. So maybe it's a lot more time consuming and longer, or they don't want to do the paperwork. I don't know, but it seems like just to be safe, why wouldn't you just get one every time?
Well, it's just a matter of short circuiting it. I mean, because really they don't want to have to go through the formalities of it, because usually a search warrant, they're going to find probable cause to give you a search warrant. I mean, it's just almost kind of a rubber stamp, I think, at certain times, but you know, maybe they don't want to disclose the different sources. Maybe they don't want to disclose why they have probable cause to want to search this person's thing. Maybe they got it from an informant and they don't want to turn over that person's name or something along those lines. I mean, there could be a lot of reasons for it. But I think that having a judge look it over makes it much better.
It seems like it's better to be safe than sorry, you know?
Yeah,
you're better off
so.
To get it and not have to face that scrutiny, because it's not a question of whether you can get it. It's just a question of how you go about getting it.
Well, here's the thing, too. Like, I don't really care if somebody knows where I am and they track my cell phone data and things like that. I mean, it's not a big deal to me. I'm not doing anything that's wrong. So the whole thought is like, well, I'm not doing anything wrong, so why should I care? Because I think you need to care about it, because you have a reasonable expectation of privacy for them to know where you are and what you're doing. They just can't go sniffing through your business just willy-nilly without some sort of good reason. And I think they should have to show that good reason to the judge. And I think that's kind of my whole thought about it. Anyway.
Well, I would take that to the superhero level.
Yeah.
I mean, Batman's out patrolling Gotham City.
Mm-hmm.
And Batman's in Gotham City. I'm not a big comic book guy, but I know a little bit. So he's patrolling Gotham City and his bat senses tingle and he senses something's happening. And so he intervenes. Did that guy have a right to privacy and Batman violated his rights because he came and intervened, him committing his evil ne'er-do-well activities?
Well, he's not a government actor, so no.
He's a quasi-government. He operates with the permission of the government. They don't arrest him or nothing.
He operates under the color of law.
That's right. He operates as a law official. They cooperate and take the people into prison. They always take them in.
You might be able to make that nexus because they do have a bat sign up on top of City Hall where they call him.
That's right.
So
there, that's tied to government.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. I'm real mixed on this. I understand what you're saying. You know, all you young liberal guys that say we should be free and I don't want Big Brother looking over my shoulder. But some of us older guys that are, you know, that have been through the stuff, we say maybe it would be a deterrent if we did monitor everybody so that you could head off some of these things. Why do we want criminals to have privacy?
It's not just criminals having privacy. It's everybody having privacy.
Yeah, but if you're not doing anything, what difference does it make? If we're talking about it's just like random drug testing. Well, it violates my privacy. Yeah, but if it's catching people that are violating and doing that, then maybe they won't do it anymore if you can't get away with it.
You don't have a right to my pee.
Well, I know. We're never going to agree on that. So no. That's the target. But I'm just saying that if, you know, it can do good. It's like a lot of things. It can be used for good. It can be used for bad. But if it cut down on the crime rate and it increased convictions or whatever, then it's a good thing.
You think we need to increase convictions?
If it's done the right way.
There are so many convictions out there. People plead guilty and people go to jail all the time. We have the highest rate of incarceration in the United States.
Well, maybe I'm talking about more for violent crimes and not. I mean, I think we have too many convictions that are going on because of drug laws. I think there's far too much stuff from the drug laws that's clogging up the courts and the prisons.
Have you ever seen the movie Minority Report with Tom Cruise?
I have, but it's been so long I don't really remember.
Well, that's basically a movie where they have the ability to see the future, and they arrest people before things happen. Mm-hmm. And let me just, spoiler alert, it's not good.
It could be if used properly.
No, it's not good.
Unfortunately, absolute power corrupts absolutely.
It's not even about that. It's just we have certain unalienable rights here in the United States, and I don't think they should ever be trampled upon because— Really, if we give up our rights just for a little bit of protection, then essentially criminals and terrorists would win. It's just not right.
What if we gave it up for a lot of protection?
I don't need a lot of protection. I'm good.
That's what she said.
Well, so I want to get into this U.S. v. Carpenter case. For that, I think we might have some motions.
Oh, I need to request permission to approach the bench to pay for court costs.
You may approach. Who do we have on the docket today?
On the docket today, our good friends at DollarShaveClub.com, the smoothest shave around. Here's the reason why you need to act on this right away. I know there's a few of you out there that may have forgotten that you just missed Father's Day.
Uh-oh.
It was yesterday. At least when we release this, it will be yesterday.
I hope you called. I hope you called your dad.
Yeah, or at least got him a card. But if you're looking for the just right gift, the DollarShaveClub.com is the answer. And you can just clip out a picture of it or something and say, here, Dad, that's coming.
send him some beard clippings in the mail. Be like, hey, you don't have to worry about these anymore when you got a razor coming to you.
That's right.
Maybe that's a bad idea. Don't do that.
Don't send him beard clippings.
That's not a smart choice. But you know what is a smarter choice? Dollar Shave Club. Because you get a great shave at a great price, conveniently delivered right to your door.
It's an awesome life hack and no-brainer choice. You no longer have to schlep to the store to buy a cheap disposable razor that'll cut you up or spend a fortune on razors with gimmicky shaving tech that you don't even need.
And when you use the Dollar Shave Club Executive Razor with the Dr. Carver's Shave Butter, the blade just gently glides, giving such a smooth shave. The Shave Butter is transparent and gives more precise shave and helps prevent ingrown hairs and fights razor bumps.
You too can make the smarter choice by joining DollarShaveClub.com. Now, here's the deal. For a limited time, new members get their first month of the Executive Razor with a tube of the Dr. Carver's Shave Butter for only $5 with free shipping. After that, razors are just a few bucks a month.
That's a $15 value for only $5. In your first month box, you get an awesome weighty handle, a full cassette of 4 cartridges, and a tube of their shave butter. After your first month, replacement cartridges ship automatically at their regular price.
There are no hidden fees and no commitments. Cancel any time you like. You can only get this offer exclusively at DollarShaveClub.com. /court.
That's dollarshaveclub.com/court.
Tell them Mike and Tommy sent you.
So this U.S. v. Carpenter case, this case originated in Detroit, Michigan, and it was a federal case. It was from the Eastern District of Michigan at Detroit. And basically, it was appealed to the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. Let's just give you a little bit of background about this case. In April 2011, police arrested four men suspected of committing a string of armed robberies at Radio Shacks and T-Mobile stores in and around Detroit. One of the men confessed to the group that he had robbed nine different stores in Michigan and Ohio between December 2010 and March 2011, and this was supported by a shifting ensemble of 15 other men who served as getaway drivers and lookouts. So that could be the whole problem behind Radio Shack going out of business.
This guy single-handedly put him out of business, huh?
Yeah, I guess so.
Maybe they didn't have insurance.
So the robber who confessed to the crimes gave the FBI his own cell phone number and numbers of the other participants, and the FBI reviewed the call records to identify even more numbers that he called around the time of the robberies. In May and June of 2011, the FBI applied for three orders from magistrate judges to obtain transactional records from various wireless carriers for 16 different phone numbers. As part of those applications, the FBI recited that these records included all subscriber information, toll records, and call detail records, including listed and unlisted numbers dialed or otherwise transmitted to and from the target telephones from December 1st, 2010 till present, as well as cell site information for the target telephones at call origination and call termination for incoming and outgoing calls. The FBI also stated these records would provide evidence that Timothy Sanders, Timothy Carpenter, and the other known and unknown individuals had violated the Hobbs Act, 18 U.S.C. 1951, and the magistrate granted the applications pursuant to the Stored Communications Act, under which the government may require the disclosure of certain telecommunication records when specific and articulatable facts show that there are reasonable grounds to believe the contents of a wire or electronic communication or records or other information sought are relevant to material ongoing criminal investigation. It wasn't technically a search warrant, but they did apply to get the court to issue this.
Well, that's like the next best thing to a search warrant, isn't it? I mean, if the court agrees to it?
Well, it's not. It's a different standard. And so there needs to be a probable cause standard. So basically, the government charged Carpenter with six counts and Sanders with two of aiding and abetting robbery that affected interstate commerce. And again, that's how they touch on the federal stuff, because whenever you have a federal thing involved and it's interstate commerce, that's how you under the Commerce Clause. And it was basically in violation of the Hobbs Act, and they carried a firearm during the federal crime of violence. And before trial, Carpenter and Sanders moved to suppress the government's cell site evidence on Fourth Amendment grounds, saying that the records could only be seized with a warrant supported by probable cause, and the district court denied that motion. So that was kind of the setup for that. Whenever you have cases like this, if you have some evidence that you think was seized improperly, you do a motion to suppress that evidence. And that basically, if you win on that motion to suppress, then the court cannot introduce that kind of information, or the state cannot introduce that information to the court.
And right? If that's the crux of your case, you may not want to go forward with your case, or you may want to postpone it, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Or, I mean, it could lead to them dismissing the case or ultimately giving you some sort of better plea deal or something along those lines.
Well, didn't you say he told the other ones that he had done those crimes?
Well, he had confessed to it, but basically...
Well, if he confessed to it, that's pretty good evidence.
It's pretty good evidence, but, you know, they want to have more and more. So, and sometimes these confessions might not
necessarily... Did they beat it out of him with a rubber hose?
Possibly. You never know. Or maybe they didn't give him his Miranda rights as they're supposed to before they did that. So, essentially, the issue turned around basically this introduction of the cell phone tower uses. And, I mean, they may have gone... I mean, there may be enough evidence to have put them away with the other stuff, but the state went ahead and introduced this cell phone tower evidence.
So now that makes it challengeable.
And so,
I think that's happening in a lot of cases. I read where there's several high profile cases where they're having to go back to court, and it has to do with people now challenging that. I don't think it was really challenged that much. I think that the thinking was when it first started being used, they got him. You know, there's not much you can do.
Yeah.
Now they're challenging the concept of it. I think lawyers, you know, somebody along the line said, hey, let's challenge this. I mean, I read one where they called it junk science because they say it doesn't go to your cell phone when you make a call, does not go to the nearest tower. It goes to the clearest tower.
Mm-hmm.
One where we'll channel your call quicker. You know, if one tower is being hit by a bunch of calls being made, your call may go to one further away, but isn't being bombarded with calls right now. So they're saying that this is, in their opinion, of course, they're the ones defending their clients, that it's junk science. And, you know,
well, at the trial, FBI agent Christopher Hess, he offered expert testimony regarding the cell site data. And that was from Metro PCS and T-Mobile. And the way he explained it is that cell phones work by establishing a radio connection with nearby cell towers or cell sites, that cell phones are constantly searching for the strongest signal from those towers, or the clearer one, like you said, and that the individual towers project different signals in each direction or sector, so that cell phone location on the north side of a cell tower will use a different signal than a cell phone located on the south side of the same tower. And he said that cell towers are generally spaced widely in rural areas, might be as far as 20 miles. But in urban areas like Detroit, however, that the cell site can cover anywhere from a half mile to 2 miles.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a big difference.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, and especially if you're pinpointing where somebody's at.
Yeah. So they basically created maps showing that these two guys were within a half mile to 2 miles of the location of each of the robberies around the time the robberies happened. So that's pretty damning evidence right there.
Yeah, I would say so. So this is the crux of what they're proceeding to the Supreme Court. Is that the last court before it goes to Supreme Court? The one that just
right. Well,
you struck them down.
Yes, because in federal court, what you have is like the Eastern District or the trial court. That's just the basic federal court. And then you have the District Court of Appeals, and then you have the U.S. Supreme Court. And this, what I'm talking about was basically from the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. So they're the ones who were over top that Eastern District of Michigan. So this is the intermediate level of appellate review. So the jury convicted him, and here's probably why they went ahead and appealed anything they probably could, is because Carpenter, his conviction, he got 4 mandatory minimum prison sentences of 25 years, each to be conserved consecutively, leaving him with sentencing guidelines range of 1,395 to 1,428 months. So I think that was like 100 years. And then basically,
he'll be pretty old when he gets out.
Yeah, yeah, he's not gonna be getting anytime
soon.
He
won't know how to operate the cell phone at that point.
And
he'll be like my dad with it.
Yes. So basically, they're challenging this introduction of the cell phone tower, and what they are relying on is essentially what I talked about before, and this is what the District Court of Appeals, the Sixth Circuit, said, and they're talking about Katz and the Fourth Amendment. Basically, to fall within the protections of the Fourth Amendment, an expectation of privacy must satisfy a twofold requirement. First, the person asserting it must have exhibited actual subjective expectation of privacy, and second, that expectation must be one that society is prepared to recognize as reasonable, and that was from Katz. Then they went on to talk about Smith v. Maryland. When an expectation of privacy meets both of these requirements, the government action that invades the expectation normally counts as a search. And therefore, if it counts as a search, there must be probable cause and there must be a warrant. So that is the analysis that the District Court of Appeals used when they were reviewing this. And that's going to set up probably the legal arguments in front of the Supreme Court. Are they going to follow Katz, University of Maryland? Are they going to follow the U.S. v. Maryland? Or are they going to look at this
as something, Terps.
They're going to look at something different? And this is going to be the ACLU's point of view, is that because cell phone location records can reveal countless private details of our lives, police should only be able to access them by getting a warrant based on probable cause. The ACLU basically released a statement, said the time has come for the Supreme Court to make it clear that the longstanding protections of the Fourth Amendment apply to undiminished force to these kinds of sensitive digital records. So they had a chance to actually review this same thing previously in 2015, but they declined to. And just recently, I think it was like last week, they decided that, you know what, we are actually going to review this case.
Okay, because the Supreme Court can decide whether they're going to hear the case or not. And if they say no, then it basically, that Court of Appeals was the last resort.
Denied. Yeah.
That's the end of the story.
Yeah, so in the previous case in 2015, that was it. They said, well, we're not going to hear this case. They decided not to rule on it. But I guess there's been enough controversy on this issue now that they decide, hey, we're going to talk about it and see what we can figure out. So,
well, you know, cell phone evidence was one of the things that put away Aaron Hernandez in his murder trial.
Yeah, it was, wasn't it?
Yeah. So maybe his lawyer could challenge it and maybe he'll get out.
I think it was out. He's out now, isn't he?
Yeah, he's out.
Okay.
He's out and about. No, actually, he's no longer a murderer.
Yeah, yeah, that's right, because of the weird that weird law.
Yeah, they have a law there that if it's under appeal and you die, then your name is cleared.
Yeah.
So now he could go to heaven, I guess.
I think I read somewhere, someone was telling me that basically that was some sort of insurance thing or some sort of a legal thing that he tried to do that so basically his heirs wouldn't have any responsibility or culpability or something.
Really?
Yeah, because... I don't know if that was true or not. I'm just kind of talking out of thin air here. But if you think about it, if there was some sort of theory of liability that his estate would be held liable for him murdering people or whatever like that, and then basically it was appealed and he killed himself or died during the course of the appeal and he's therefore not guilty or, you know, not actually convicted, then therefore that theory of liability based on that murder conviction would be moot.
Hmm.
So.
Well. I guess so. And there could be property things that might have been tied up as a result of what he had done. And now yeah. He's not a convicted murderer maybe it frees it up.
Yeah, who knows? So, but yeah, this is like you said, the technological advances, they keep the Fourth Amendment constantly in change.
Well, so. And you know, also people's understanding, you know, because when the law probably first started using this, that all the experts were on their side. And now you've got people that work in that industry that understand it. And, you know, now defense lawyers maybe get them out and get them to give them enough information where they feel like they have footing to stand on to say, well, this isn't exactly right. This isn't how that works. They've told us this is correct, but this isn't exactly right, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe they've got, as people learn more about it, you also can learn where the weak points are, I guess, is what I'm saying. And there may be weak points in that where it's not so cut and dried.
Yeah.
That it's just, if it pings there, that's where you were. Maybe that's not 100%. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think in the technology we have today, I think it probably is pretty daggone accurate. And I don't have a problem with the police getting that information, but I just want them to have to go through that extra hurdle of having probable cause to do it. I mean, essentially what can happen is that you just have to be driving through an area and they get all this data about who was driving through that area and you happen to be the person driving through there, then all of a sudden they're up in your business, even though you had nothing to do with it. So, I mean, they should have some sort of, you know, probable cause to search those kinds of records, I think.
It's funny you should mention that. I have a situation that I came across in our research for this that's right along those same lines, that you were driving through the area and became a person of interest.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was in Canada. Now, I know we're talking about U.S. law, but I would assume that, you know, Canada law has the same type questions going on in the usage of it. They had a murder of a 65-year-old hitchhiker that took place in December of 2015. Well, it's still unsolved, but they came up with an idea to try to solve it. They got a data dump. That'd be a big dump. They got a data dump of everybody that was in this 300-mile radius where this guy had last been seen. And it involved approximately 7,500 mobile phones that were in the vicinity between 12:30 and 3:30 on December 16th.
That's a lot of phones.
Now, what they're doing is they're sending all these people, or they've done it now, they sent all these people a text message about this murder with a picture of the guy and the details of it and offering a $50,000 reward. And they're not trying to find the suspects. They're trying to find witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
So they're telling them, you know, here's a picture of the guy. Here's what happened. Did you see anything? Because you were in the area. Please respond back. So all they've got to do is text back their answer of if they did anything. But they're using that to try to solve a murder.
Yeah.
With that, they're not trying to catch the criminal exactly, although I think there could be ulterior motives.
Yeah.
What if everybody that doesn't respond back, they come knocking at your door? Because if you're the guy that did it, you're not going to respond back and say, yeah, I saw something. You're just going to let it go.
You look like the guy I see in the mirror every morning when I shave with my Dollar Shave Club razor.
Yeah. That could have been him. He was driving a car just like mine. Or the guy's dumb enough to turn himself in for the $50,000 reward.
Yeah, right? I need that money. That's interesting. I heard a story about there was a hunter that was killed shot by another hunter here in West Virginia.
That happens every year.
Well, it does.
Several times.
The person whoever did it, they never figured out who did it originally. And then what they did is they went through the records to figure out who was hunting in that area because it was like a permit area. And they were able to talk to people and found a witness. And one of the witnesses actually said that they saw somebody leaving that exact same area. And then they were able to also find the hat, and they were able to search where the hat was purchased as well. And so there was two different ways they were able to track down who it was. And so they ended up convicting the guy. So,
well, that's good.
Yeah.
Catch him.
Shot a guy and just ran off.
All right. Now I have one more case, and it's even more famous than any of the other ones that we've talked about. This is the case that was outlined on Making a Murderer.
Oh, yeah.
They are now using the lawyer that he now has is using cell phone data to prove that Stephen Avery did not kill that, was it Teresa Halbach? The prosecution, they introduced where he had called her using, I don't know what this is, star 67, which blocks your ID or something like that.
Yeah, if you hit star 67, then dial a number, your number comes up private or no.
Something like that. Yeah. Doesn't say who's calling.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I do that sometimes. I have to call clients from my cell phone.
so they can't call you back, right?
Exactly.
So they introduced evidence where he had called her twice on the day she was supposed to be coming to take pictures using star 67 when he called, I guess, to block his ID. Mm-hmm. So they introduced that as kind of like against him, that she had said she had some kind of problem with him.
Yeah.
And so they were saying he was hiding his identity so she wouldn't know it was him, so she would come back and take the pictures, or was he just simply wanting her to come back, you know, to do what ended up happening?
Yeah.
But they never introduced any of the information that showed the tracking of her cell phone. And what they found is when they went back and recreated it, they have a map of the whole thing, and they're going back and comparing it to statements that were made, and they're showing where she was moving away and hitting cell towers away from his property, and was actually the last ping was 12 miles away from Stephen Avery's property.
Hmm.
And, you know, there was, if you watch that whole thing, there was the one officer that they were cross-examining, and they asked him about a call that came in with a description of a car abandoned along the road that matched her car. He said, oh, no, nothing ever came of that. You know, this was like a day or two before they found the car sitting in his lot, Stephen Avery's lot,
yeah,
by a volunteer looker, searcher, who had just been sent, had basically been said, look, you walk in right there and look right there and see if you find anything.
Yeah.
And she walks in and walks right to it, and there it is.
Yeah, because it was in the back part of the yard where you wouldn't ever.
Yeah, and this was like 3 days into the search or something like that.
Yeah.
And people, you know, all kinds of people, including the police, had been through there. And all of a sudden, she just walks right in and walks right to it 10 minutes after she starts searching. I mean, a lot of it's fishy. But then this would also answer, if that car was found there and that matches with that 12 miles away, all right, I don't think the police killed her, but maybe somebody else did. And the police just figured, well, we'll just tie it right back to him.
Yeah.
Because they were wanting to keep him from getting those millions of dollars he was getting for the false imprisonment for the first time they did it wrong.
Could be.
But this cell phone technology is coming into play for them. They're looking at it. It wasn't even mentioned the first time around.
Yeah.
Of course, that was, what, 10 years ago?
I think so. I can't remember when it was, but yeah.
So I think they have better ways to analyze it now. And that's exactly what they're finding, is that there's data to show that she had left there, and it also, they're using that for the time frame because there was a discrepancy in the time frames that were given between when he said she arrived there and when other people said she arrived there. And then she also had another stop that she had made that hadn't been talked about. So there's a lot of interesting scenario. And then I saw something today. I didn't get to read the article. Something today where their theory is, the defense theory is actually that her ex-boyfriend is the one that killed her.
And then framed that guy?
Yeah. And, you know, he was on the scene involved in the search.
That sounds fishy.
I don't know.
Yeah, that cell phone tower data can be used for a lot of good. I just think that if you're going to get it, better have a warrant.
Well, I understand, but I don't know. I guess we'll have to agree to disagree on that because, you know, what are we doing to deter crime? Apparently prison terms don't deter crime. The death penalty doesn't deter crime.
Nope.
What does deter crime? If you knew you were going to get caught every time you did something, would that not deter crime?
I think it's rehabilitation and breaking the cycle from an early age. I think that's the best way to do it.
Well, all right, but you still gotta catch them before you can do that.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I think if we have, you know, better policy about dealing with juveniles and things like that, that we might be able to help them more. I don't know. I don't have the answer. All I know is that you better have a warrant.
You don't have the answer. You're a lawyer. I'm just have a dude.
Warrant. You better have a warrant.
I'm just a dude. If you don't have the answers, we're screwed.
Probably. Well, that's going to bring us to Legal Briefs is the part of the show where we talk about different legal terms that we mention. And I usually ask Tommy and see if he can remember what they are. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Pin register.
That was that thing that the cell phones went through and it tracked the number to numbers, that what number called what number and stuff like that, that the telephone company had, that they used the data from it to catch somebody.
Well, it was phones, but it wasn't cell phones. It was back in 1979, and that was basically for the hard lines and how they kept track of the phone numbers. So that's half right, I think.
Well, half right. That's about me. I'm half-assed.
What is the number of the amendment to the Constitution that protects against unreasonable search and seizure?
I plead the fourth. I plead the fourth. I don't know. I can't do the rap like he does.
That's right. It's the Fourth Amendment.
Let's see. There's so many to choose from. I choose number four.
All right. Now, can you name the federal courts in the proper order from beginning to final appeal?
There's the circuit courts. There's like the Eastern District Circuit Courts. And I guess there's a Western District Circuit Court and stuff like that.
We don't have to name them all.
And then they go to the U.S. Court of Appeals that's for their district or whatever it is, covers their area, region or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes to the Supreme Court.
Right. Well, you have the trial court.
U.S. Supreme Court.
You got that.
Well, the trial court's the original
yep.
one, right?
It's original.
Yeah, that's on the state level or yep. whatever.
Well, no, it's not on the state level. It's a federal court. But there's several throughout states generally.
Like oh, so that's – but you all right, so you would get – this guy gets arrested. All right, he gets convicted. That's by the state, right?
Nope.
Oh.
Nope. So basically, the way this case panned out, the U.S. v. Carpenter that we were talking about, there was the Eastern District of Michigan at Detroit. And that was the trial court. And that was in federal court because it was federal laws he violated because it was...
Oh, okay. So that's the difference. But if you start out in the state, how do you end up at the U.S. Supreme Court? Can you not?
Yeah, you can appeal that too, but it goes through the state appellate levels, then it goes to the U.S. Supreme Court.
I got you.
So this case was appealed from the federal court, then it went to the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, which was in that whole area, and now it's going to the U.S. Supreme Court. So that's the names of the courts.
Okay,
so
I guess I was confused, the state and federal
yep.
type courts, so it depends on what kind of crime.
Yep, or what where that's the
whether it's a state one or a federal one.
Generally where the jurisdiction lies.
Well, the number one rule to remember is, as Beretta used to tell us, don't do the crime if you can't do the time.
That's good advice. And the last term, I didn't define it, but I mentioned it, exculpatory.
Exculpatory, that means stuff you can't mention.
No, exculpatory is any kind of evidence that would prove your innocence.
Oh, exculpatory evidence is stuff that proves your innocence?
In a nutshell, yeah.
And what do you call stuff that proves your guilt?
Everything else. The facts.
No. Where do alternative facts lie and all that?
No, that's just basically any other kind of evidence. So exculpatory evidence is the stuff that the state has the duty to, or the U.S. government has the duty to turn over to you if you request it. So basically, if they know that you have evidence that shows you're innocent, they got to give it to you. So
that's basically like parole evidence.
No, not at all.
It's not in the four corners. That's just the stuff you're making up to try to beat the rap.
It has nothing to do with parole evidence. And if you think it does, anyone out there listening to this podcast, just wash that from your memory because it's not anything like it.
That's a false memory.
Yes.
We planted it in your brain. I did.
Yeah.
Mike had nothing to do with it.
Scrub it with bleach. Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Doctor, Lawyer, Indian Chief.
And thanks to the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for the use of their recording studio. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, and Still Buffering, as well as many other fine offerings. And please, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. If you didn't, well, then not so much.
You're not supposed to say that.
You always edit that out, though, right?
Usually. Good. This has been Court Appointed. I'm Mike Meadows, your co-host. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurf. And I'm just a dude.